Thomas Metzinger is one of the world's most distinguished thinkers in the area of consciousness and philosophy of mind. He is currently Professor of Theoretical Philosophy at the Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz, Germany, where he is also the Director of the Neuroethics Research Unit. He is also an Adjunct Fellow at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Study, where he also serves as Director of the Mind Group. Formerly, Metzinger has been President of the German Cognitive Science Society and of the Association of the Scientific Study of Consciousness. His focus of research lies in analytical philosophy of mind and cognitive science, as well as in connections between ethics, philosophy of mind, and anthropology. In the English language, he has edited two collections on consciousness, one titled Conscious Experience, published by Paderborn Press, and Neurocorrelates of Consciousness, published by MIT Press. He has also published one major scientific monograph developing a comprehensive, interdisciplinary theory about consciousness, the phenomenal self, and the first-person perspective, titled Being No One, the Self-Model Theory of Subjectivity, published by MIT Press. My first question as an initial starting point would be that consciousness itself is a subject matter with a long contentious history, dating back to the ancient philosophical world, perhaps given more prominence in the modern period under Descartes in terms of dualism, the problem of the mind-body. Slightly is a bit of an understatement, but it's been challenged more in the 20th century under the guise of objective external study of neuroscience, which studies brain states and initially their correlation to any conscious phenomena, which itself has also given rise to a lot of controversial philosophical debate. We've got issues of the hard problem, how it is that some kind of mental phenomenon can come out of a material brain, something espoused to a certain extent by Joseph Levine and more propagated by David Chalmers. But from your perspective as an expert in philosophy of mind, as a starting point, how would you first go about trying to define consciousness itself?
Well, the very first thing one should maybe look at is that there was a beautiful philosopher, Cathy Wilkes, at St. Hilda's College in Oxford, who pointed out in 1988 that more than 90% of the linguistic communities in the world don't have a word for consciousness. So the philosophical problem of consciousness is, of course, also relative to a very certain kind of Western philosophy history of ideas. I've looked into this a bit. Of course, there are centuries, for instance, of thinking about the Latin precursor, conscientia, which was something very different from the notion of phenomenal experience we would have in present day philosophical debates. It had to do with a moral conscience and with higher order moral judgments and with Christian philosophy and the idea of an inner court where you would constantly evaluate even your mental thoughts, like your thoughts, was this a good thought? Should I have had this emotion from a moral perspective? So there are centuries of thinking about consciousness before modernity, before Descartes, that are focused on a slightly different notion. Then the Greeks, Zeneticists, they had ideas that it has to do with the union of the senses. And that is a motive we still find today. The notion of global integration, the classical problem of the unity of consciousness, that was seen in antiquity that, so to speak, when your senses come together, when you can hear what you see at the same time, then you're aware. If the senses come apart, then you go to sleep or you faint or you die. So if you look at these centuries of Western history of the concept of consciousness, one element is integration that we still have today. Another element that we also still have in today's debate is meta-representation. So thinking about what you're thinking about, being aware, as it were, of the fact that you are currently perceiving or that you are aware. We have this in all these different, you know, higher order perception, higher order thought theories of consciousness. But the moral element that consciousness has something to do with having a conscience has completely disappeared in the last 350 years. And I think part of the progress today in this very hot interdisciplinary field of consciousness research, you may know that I'm one of the people who founded the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness 22 years ago, is that we have decomposed problem space. So we know there are some problems that are more conceptual, others are more empirical, and there are different aspects. The global unity, why is this one world that appears to me? But then something that is still frequently confused, the difference between consciousness and self-consciousness. What does it mean to be aware of yourself for a creature? Then the very important issue of what a first-person perspective is, and so on and so forth. We have evolutionary theories about how consciousness could have emerged. So the landscape is very differentiated today, and I think that's a sign of progress.
Just to probe you a bit further on those issues, so this idea of consciousness being a unique first-person perspective that to a certain extent no one else has actual access to internally, you can obviously look at it externally and objectively through brain scans, but no one can actually get that first-person perspective of qualia. I've read some of your work before where you say that the experience of consciousness is a unique natural phenomenon in terms of where it can be experienced from the inside and from the outside. Explain a bit more about the differences in this empirical and conceptual approach to the study of consciousness.
Well, I think one way to look at it is to say that conscious experience is a model of reality. I don't think that it always contains a self model. As you may know, I've written a lot about self models, but there are important states of consciousness in which there is no first person perspective. I think it's plausible to assume, for instance, in severe psychiatric syndromes, but also in deep spiritual experiences, in religious experiences, we have reports about this from millennia, from different cultures and religious backgrounds. So one may assume, I think, that self-consciousness is not a necessary condition for consciousness as such to appear. And there may be aperspectival forms of conscious experience where there is no center and not the experience of a knowing self. But maybe we put this aside for a while. So on the highest level, I think the problem would be to explain global integration and find the global neural correlate of consciousness. I think the scientific way to proceed is like this, to combine phenomenological reports in an intelligent way with specific research about neural correlates. And if one has isolated the minimally sufficient neural correlate, say for something, an experience of blue or a tummy ache or something, then that doesn't help anything at all. One needs a functional analysis of this biological hardware. That is, we need a story about how information flows in that neural correlate and how it is processed. And then the really tricky question, and that's of course in the future, we are not there yet, is to find the right level of granularity in the computational analysis of the neural correlates of consciousness that maps onto what subjects really report. Just to name one philosophically very interesting problem is there may be aspects of consciousness that cannot be mapped because they are ineffable, because even the best scientific subject in a lab could not report it. I'll give you two examples. One is the selfless experiences I've talked about already. They seem to be ineffable by nature. It's even a question, if there was no self there at the time, how should anybody have an autobiographical memory of these experiences and report them? So methodologically, it's very difficult to take reports about selfless states of consciousness seriously. But then also on the lowest level of conscious experiences, in the very subtle nuances of sensory experiences, I think there's a very beautiful discovery there that has been made around 1995, that there is a level of ineffability in sensory experience. So many people talk about qualia, and most of them don't know what they actually are. The Classical Locus is a book by Clarence Irving Lewis, 1929, Mind and the World Order. He was a professor of logics in San Francisco. And he defined qualia after centuries of discussion about secondary qualities as first order phenomenal properties, the redness of red, the sweetness of sweet, which are the simplest form of consciousness, conscious experience, and which we can recognize from one instance to the other. So we do have, as philosophers would say, introspective identity criteria. What does that mean? That means if I show you two, I think the English word is swatches or pieces of red cards, and you have to determine the sameness of the red. And you say, no, they are not the same. This is red 36 and this is red 37. And they are nearest neighbors, what you can discriminate. And then I put these color cards behind my back and show you only one and say, which one was that? Was it 36 or 37? You can actually not re-identify it. So there are things, and that's, I think, is a beautiful discovery in human sensory experience that are so subtle and so nuanced that we can discriminate them in an online situation. We can say, no, this is not the same red, but we cannot categorize, we cannot recognize them over time. And that contradicts the classical notion of a quale that most philosophers actually use for their discussions. There is something more subtle than qualia, actually, in the classical sense of the term, and that may be ineffable. If you can't remember if that was red 36 or red 37, if I've briefly had both cards behind my back, then how are we going to tell, you know, the neural correlates? I'm just mentioning the second kind of ineffability to draw your attention to the fact that there may be very deep methodological issues, actually, in consciousness research. How do you scientifically explain something that is too subtle to report? But it's there. Arguably, these are the best parts of our conscious life. These very subtle, think about taste or smell, these very subtle nuances. And I think that is something the philosophical discussion has already shown. There's a wonderful philosopher by the name of Diana Raffman who has first discovered it, that there may be some aspects of sensory experience that are not easy to scientifically explain, not because they're mysteries, but because it's methodologically, it's a big problem. So, and I find discoveries like these, I find really beautiful because they also show, leave academic philosophy and all the complicated stuff aside for a moment, that there are things in our own conscious experience that you really can only savor it, as you might say, or only experience in the present moment. In an online situation, that's where you have these very subtle nuances in sound, in smell, in color, and you can't think about them. You lose it if you don't attend in the very moment. It also makes good evolutionary sense. Think about a hedgehog that's walking through the grass and sniffing, has an online situation, and it has to distinguish which fruits that have fallen down are still good and which are already rotten. It needs that high discrimination in the online situation, but the computational load in remembering it all would just be not economical for its brain. So in online situations, we have a very subtle and fine experience. And I think modern consciousness research shows that a lot of this can simply not be reported in offline situations. That may be an obstacle for empirical research.
Just to clarify two issues there. So going back to this idea of the unified integrated self, which can be not just problematic to study, but also in terms of its objective existence. So obviously you gave the example of people experiencing these elevated spiritual states where they feel selfless and not connected to one's own self-identity. They feel involved in some kind of universal unity with something that identifies with apart from their self. In terms of the processing of the unconscious operations in your brain and therefore to a certain extent mind, if some of your processing that goes on is unconscious, then that obviously causes problems for the idea, the notion of oneself understanding if a lot of your processes is not actually in your own conscious control.
That's right. So first of all, almost all of our intelligence is unconscious intelligence. What we consciously experience is just a very small partition of the overall state space our brain opens. And that is just also the problem about consciousness. Does this have any causal effect? What is this very small section of all of it has to be processed on this level of conscious processing? What does the phenomenology of it add? And we have some ideas. Conscious processing is more flexible. Unconscious processing is more rigid, but faster. Conscious processing is more context sensitive and not so schematic like unconscious things. Like, imagine a child calls you and asks you, how do I tie my shoes? It's very hard. You have to put the telephone down. When you learned it from your parents, you did it consciously. But when the motor routine is finished, it sinks down into your unconscious mind. Only if you have to teach it to another conspecific, you have to make it conscious again. You have no idea how you actually do this. And so being unconscious is often a form of success, a form of high intelligence. Now, the one interesting aspect is conscious experience also seems to enable veto control. So as these classical experiments on freedom of the will have shown, Patrick Haggard and all these people, there are small time windows in which you can veto, say, a pointing or a grasping movement. And I think a sleepwalker at night who's entirely unconscious has no veto control. He's really a robot. And he's also not very context sensitive. They do hurt themselves. They do fall down, actually. They have rigid behavioral patterns. So consciousness may add a certain level of autonomy in veto control. But it is very important, once having said that, to also explain that there is no free won't. Of course, the conscious decision to veto, say, an arm movement or something, has an unconscious precursor as well. There are physical conditions that fully determine this as well. So the big question is, of course, what is the relation of conscious and unconscious, say, thoughts in our minds? And I've recently developed this metaphor in an MIT book, in a chapter I wrote with a fantastic young Ukrainian philosopher, Yulia Plyush, which we called the dolphin model of cognition. So dolphins do something like porpoising, I think is the English word. You know, they jump in and out of the water. And actually that has advantages. It saves resistance for long distance travel. It's efficient for these animals. And I think we actually think like that. So if a thought pops into our mind, the preceding chain, cognitive chain, has actually been under the water surface. And then suddenly the dolphin jumps out and we have a conscious thought that says, oh my God, I still have to buy milk. Or, the traffic light has turned yellow while you were mind wandering about something else waiting at the traffic light. And then for a certain time, there is introspectable thought, and then boops, it goes down under the surface. And that metaphor also says that there's a school of dolphins. There are multiple threads of unconscious processing going on in you all of the time. And sometimes some jump out of the water into the space of introspective availability. Now, imagine you are a system that has to constantly not only predict what happens in the world, but has to predict what happens in its own mind. I think that has a lot to do with the origin of self-consciousness. We have to predict our own behavior because we are such complex systems. Now, suddenly a dolphin jumps up in your own mind. It's a complete surprise. It's a conscious event you did not predict on the conscious level of processing. A good hypothesis to explain a surprise away is I did this. There was no, I cannot introspect any causal precursor because it was unconscious. So the natural hypothesis on the level of conscious processing, that would be my theory, is what philosophers call ultimate origination. I have the force. I am a being that can start causal chains. I'm an ultimate originator. This is my decision. I started it now. This is my veto control, motor command. I'm going to stop moving my hand right now. So in trying to explain away the sudden surprise, my theory says, on the conscious level, it is like the self is automatically created as the cause, for instance, of conscious thought change. Because how else would the system explain to itself what is constantly happening, you know, thoughts popping up? So having a self model also has something to do with developing a model of what you actually do and with predictive control. You also want to control, if you want to think logically, you want to control a train of thought. It's like you want to impose an order on it and want it to go in a certain way, the dolphin. And that is actually maybe something that a conscious self model enables, predictive control of one's own thought processes, but involving a certain amount of confabulation, namely that there is a thinker of thoughts.
Just to summarize some points then, this problem of the unified self, this subjective experience, can be problematic and at least tested and questioned in terms of in the moment, real time, contextual online situation. So obviously you give an example of the hedgehog that goes through the field and it has to observe its natural phenomena in that space and time frame. So obviously a lot of that stuff will be unconscious processing. It therefore hasn't got time to speculate or propagate the notion of the self. And within this framework is where people really start to question the construction of the self and whether it's a self-constructed conceptual tool such as a mode of one's individual agency in control of themselves. And that obviously causes questions in terms of this idea of this unified self-experience that moves from point A to point B, which a lot of people question. So because of this contextual online situation and because of the asymmetrical nature of time, a person that moves from point A to point B may not be the same person in terms of the self. So for example, when you drink loads of coffee in the morning, you're not the same type of person when you're extremely tired. So that's the kind of issue that brings up problems for the self in general. This idea that you have a unified notion of the self that is timeless and changeless throughout the life is problematic for the reasons you've just stated in terms of unconscious processing. Then when events pop up that you cannot causally explain, you then postulate the idea of a self that's in control. With that in mind, lots of thinkers in this area, both in philosophy and neuroscience, advocate this position. Michael Graziano at Princeton says that basically the notion of the self is this residual property that comes out of modal brain states, and it is really just a self-constructed system for understanding one's own conscious experience. And that sounds something similar to what you're saying.
I don't really like the term construction because it involves an agent that does the construction. The miracle is even that there is this agentless dynamical self-organization of the experience of being an agent. But I think we have to understand that the human self model has very different levels. I think the hedgehog very certainly has a deep form of bodily self-awareness. It has to predict its own body movements and the sensations that will arise from it. The hedgehog very likely also has affective states and emotions that tell him, does this have a good value for survival or does this have a negative value for survival? But as Carl Friston has recently beautifully put it, with having a mind of the more human kind of mind, it is as if there is a thickness in time that is evolving in our brains. And that thickness in time is human beings predict in much longer into the future. And human beings have episodic memory. They remember explicit episodes from their past. And this extended predictive horizon, I think that is very important to understand the human form of consciousness. So the human self model, as you know, I'm saying my core thesis is that there are no souls and no substantial selves, but naturally evolved self models in our brain. But because they are transparent, because we cannot experience them as model, we fully identify with their content. And that is how selfhood emerges. And of course, it has levels. Human beings have bodily self-consciousness. It's very rich and works very well. It's optimized over millions of years. We have emotions which are already not that optimal and cause a lot of conflict. But then we can also really plan into the future, and we can, you know, predict future events, situations of our own body in the future, situations of our own group, our society in the future. And that's my hypothesis, is where the need of a robust illusion for transtemporal identity comes in. That is to say, transtemporal identity, that's the philosophical problem with asking the question, what is a person? What is the transtemporal identity of persons? And you have just yourself said it cannot be found on the physical and on the psychological level. All our physical, functional, and psychological properties are in flux. They change over time. So it cannot be found there. So why do we have this robust, that's an interesting form of conscious experience, actually much more interesting than redness or blueness. Why do we have this robust experience that somehow we're the same guy as the guy that was playing in the garden at the age of 5? What is this red thread in our lives? An evolutionary hypothesis I would put forward is that in organizing large-scale cooperation in societies, in human societies, where large groups of conspecifics had to work together successfully without having, you know, the chance to directly sniff at each other or get to know each other, you need something like a reputation. You need reputation management. That's a guy who keeps his promises. That's a good guy. This guy is a crook. So you need a social institution that actually says, whatever the truth is, we will treat you as the same person in the future. And if you break social rules, or if you attack the common good when we see you, then you will be punished for this in the future. And to make this causally efficient, on the level of motivation, it needs a firm belief that I will suffer if they catch me doing this. And as we know, all human beings are like that. If they feel observed by the group, they try to signal virtue. They try to look as if they're behaving good and pro-socially. As soon as they're alone, they look for ways to cheat and act much more egotistically. And in that context, the fantastic next step, so to speak, the next neurocomputational move was when your mother told you God sees everything. So if you install an omnipresent witness in your conscious mind that sees you wherever you are and who represents morality, the good, the interests of your group, then you have a very efficient way of coordinating the behavior of large groups of animals, like we large groups of apes as we are. So the first step was to mentally represent the group interests and get a conscious experience of, okay, I'm now violating the interests of the groups. And if this goes wrong, if they catch me, it is going to be myself who is going to be punished in the future. And that's why it becomes causally efficient. The state after this is you're going to even be punished after death because there is you have an immortal transtemporal identity, the soul, and somebody's observing you. So even if they don't catch you after death, you will go to hell. I mean, in this quick sketch, you can see how conscious experience isn't only blue and red and qualia. It is also how social institutions could be created with the help of conscious experience, but then kind of fed back into our own experience, and we suddenly felt the presence of God everywhere or something like this.
Yes, no, it goes to a certain extent to also explain from a evolutionary perspective the model of the self and why it's salient in organized communities. Clearly, one point, as you mentioned there, one is actual moral and social responsibility. Obviously, we're going to pin this stuff on you today, tomorrow, in the future, because you are this individual, obviously.
Exactly.
It helps you constrain you socially. Also, as you say, well, for your own reputation, perhaps, for your own self-esteem, if you've come to a decision or a thought process, if you've acted in a way that you perceive is good for yourself or possibly good for others, then that obviously is going to feed your self-esteem, as in terms of, I did this, I was right.
Yes.
So again, it propagates and builds up this sense of the self, which to a certain extent is artificial. Going on to God as being the playground schoolmaster where he's got eyes on everyone, that to a certain extent is true. But from a different facet, I think this idea that you were talking about a moment ago, where there's this unified idea that we have the self, that the person that was 5 years old playing in the garden is the same person later on in life. Historically, under different guises of literature, I think there's also a lot of religious aspects in that. And one of them, you were talking earlier about under the Latin term, conscientia means moral responsibility. Another one.
Exactly.
Another one is a lot of people see themselves as unified agents that are responsible for themselves from time point A to time point B and C because of moral free will and the fact that we are equal and created as God's children. Therefore, we must be one ontological self-entity, which obviously historically has been challenged. Just to tie some things up here, it sounds like from your work and how you further elaborated it today that this idea of the self isn't constructed in terms of one's got a rational conscious choice over it being constructed, as in it's more a unconscious process where the self has to be modelled, as something like Michael Graziano would say. To a certain extent, and I just want to get your own opinions and thoughts on this and where you stand in the spectrum, akin to someone like Daniel Dennett or the Churchlands, but this idea of first person, the self, it really is to a certain extent an illusion.
I have been guilty of writing this myself in popular writings, but illusion is, of course, a false term. An illusion is a sensory misrepresentation where there is a stimulus, like Müller-Lyer illusion. A hallucination is a sensory misrepresentation where there is no stimulus. And this very interesting property of selfhood, of having a perspective, is actually, it's grounded in sensory experience, of course, in body experience and gut feelings, breath, heartbeat, but in its higher and abstract levels of representation, it is not a sensory thing. So it also wouldn't be right to call it an illusion. But I think one deep insight that has come from people like Robert Trivers, for instance, recently is that there is an evolution of self-deception. Many people, many philosophers also have the idea that for an evolving brain, it would be good to have a more and more realistic image of the world and oneself and to depict it realistically. But actually, there are functionally adequate misrepresentations. So for beings like us, it would have been good if we all believed that you can be permanently happy with the other sex, or that children give a meaning to your life. This might not make us happy, but it improves procreative success. You know, it copies genes better. So agency is a very interesting thing. It's also where my work touches with Michael Graziano. I think we have to also see the interesting forms of the conscious experience of agency are mental. And there is cognitive agency, that intermittent experience of I am in control of my own conscious thoughts. But what most people don't see is that there is something more fundamental, namely what I call in my work attentional agency. That is the conscious experience of being able to control and sustain your focus of attention. It's like you are the entity that shifts the flashlight around, the beam of attention, if you will, the ray glands of attention. And I would say that that is actually the evolutionary origin of our phenomenology of having a perspective on the world. That is where it gets really interesting. Of course, there's bodily self-consciousness and all that, but the philosophically interesting point is when an epistemic agent model emerges. That is to say, a model of myself as an entity that controls what it will know and what it will not know. And in controlling attention, long before you start logical thought or speaking, that's when the first time as a child, as an infant, you learn that you are an epistemic agent, a knowing self that can actually select what it will want to know, see more precisely, and what it doesn't want to be distracted by right now. And I think this experience of being an entity that actively controls its own knowledge to the world and to itself, that is where the interesting form of subjectivity and selfhood starts. That is also where the problem of which animals on this planet or which machines would have a first person perspective would begin. If they had not only a world model and a self model, but if they had a model of themselves as attending. You know, this is not attentional processing itself, what you experience when you attend. It is itself a model of this optimization of precision expectations or something, some computational type might say, right? And if you have this inner model of the arrow of attention as being pointing outwards and being able to control it, that is when the experience of being a subject starts. And the big question is, of course, can that be scientifically explained? I think it can, but I may be wrong. I think we can have a neurocomputational model of exactly that. I think subjectivity in this sense can be naturalized, but this would only naturalize the conscious experience of being a subject. Philosophers would then, of course, ask, what about subjectivity in an epistemological sense, right? What is subjective knowledge as opposed to experiencing yourself as a subject? I would simply say it is a certain kind of knowledge, namely exactly the knowledge that is presented in this inner mode that I've just presented. So the knowing self, that's an inner data format that evolution has created. And all knowledge that is presented as being known by a conscious self, that is subjective knowledge. So subjectivity is, if you want to say, an epistemic modality or a neurosubjective data format or something like this. That's the way I would go. But there are deep issues there.
An interesting point there, obviously, to pick out, which most people should be aware of, is that in the context of evolution, obviously, evolution selects for traits, behaviours and phenomena that work and are useful, not that are necessarily real and true. And a lot of researchers borne that out. Just in terms of neural correlates of consciousness, philosophy of science 101 is that correlation is not causation, obviously. But you're saying that accompanied with a functional analysis to give a broader explanatory framework is what's the key to this.
Yes. So we have very dense and fine-grained correlations between conscious experience and the human brain right now. The philosopher's job is, as we say, to offer a conceptual, a metaphysical interpretation of these correlations. For conscious experience, for phenomenal content, and only for consciousness, I think the obvious and most parsimonious interpretation is identity. The content of your conscious experience is identical with a certain neurofunctional dynamics that is running in your head right now. The neurons are arbitrary. I think artificial consciousness is possible, so it doesn't need neurons. What actually is interesting is what is the functional structure that is realized by these neurons in our own case, and what are the temporal properties, the dynamics that's realized. So it's not like an abstract Turing machine table would explain it, but I think we have to get the whole temporal domain into our model of processing. And then we could, in principle, say why conscious processing is conscious processing, for instance, because it involves a model of the system as itself being an experiencing system right now. If we have that, then in principle, this could be realized on other forms of hardware. And here is, I also work in applied ethics. Here is where I always come in and say, we should not even risk creating artificial consciousness because we might greatly increase the overall amount of suffering in the universe. So we really shouldn't recklessly kick off a second order evolution in non-biological systems unless we very, very clearly know what we're actually doing here, because we could create cascades of copies and unhappy systems, and the process could get out of control. So as an ethicist, I really have argued for a moratorium on synthetic phenomenology. This should not be a goal of academic research unless we can really minimize the risks.
If we've got time, I'll get back to the issue of cyborgs and artificial intelligence in a moment. I just actually wanted to get your perspective on this whilst you're here, which is in terms of the actual use of definitions in philosophy in general, and by logical deduction is going to apply to a philosophy of mind as well. The philosopher John Hyle, who specialised in mental causation, some of his work is quite known for mental causation. I was speaking to him about this last week, and it seems to me, I just want to get your perspective on how important definitions are in this. So, for example, when someone like David Chalmers says that the hard problem really is how mental phenomena arises out of a material brain, that defining qualia and a subjective experience in a particular philosophical framework. And then at the other end of the spectrum, with someone like Daniel Dennett says that mental phenomena literally just is the same thing as a material brain phenomena. That again is playing into the roles of how you're defining it under a philosophical framework. So some of the stuff that you've been talking about, the way agency can be self-modeled, the way we might have epistemic first-person subjective experience, are these to be taken with a grain of salt in terms of you should be wary in terms of the way you're using these definitions and therefore how it then potentially affects your potential answer to a research question here? So, for example, John Hyle was saying that the problem with the mental physical divide is the way you're using the definitions and the taxonomy. You can look at it from both ends of the spectrums. Do you think that's applicable yourself? And if so, or if not, then how does that affect these definitions of the self, agency, epistemic self-knowledge? What do you think about definitions in general?
Well, I think concepts and theories are entities that move through time. They change, and they are tools and nothing more, tools by which we try to acquire knowledge about the world. And what we often don't see is that we are conscious beings using these concepts. And to be conscious also means to have intuitions. It doesn't only mean to see red and green, but also to have a conscious experience of what is possible and what is necessary. In our mental space, certain things can be easily imagined, like a functional isomorph of David Chalmers, who has no phenomenal properties. Somehow we can imagine this. It is perhaps even logically conceivable, but what that ultimately tells us is what the intuitive space is that our brains open, the modal intuitions we have about what is necessary and possible, themselves have an evolutionary history, and they're also grounded in social cultural context. So we really need hard-headed empirical science in order not to get fooled by our own intuitions. And I mean, the most counterintuitive thesis one can imagine is that there is no self. This is something one cannot imagine. I also have an explanation why nobody can imagine it, because the act of imagining is a mental action that creates a sense of effort. And as soon as you have that sense of effort, you have selfiness. So that human beings can never have a non-selfie imagination. And that is why everybody who says something like this says something deeply counterintuitive to us, something that strikes us as almost conceptually impossible. And I think all of this shows that we must be very much aware when defining our concepts and theories about conscious experiences, how they are grounded in intuitions. And our intuitions are not innocent. They have a history that's millions of years old, and they may sometimes lead us astray. So just to say that something is conceivable or possible, or that you have a strong feeling of necessity there, actually doesn't do very much. In the end, there's no way around empirical research programs that have often shown that things are counterintuitive. One of my favorite examples is a paper by Crane and Piantanida, 1981, on seeing reddish green and yellowish blue. many philosophers have said there are logically incompatible color predicates. You cannot see a homogeneously green-red. It's an impossible conscious experience. Thomas Reed, I guess, said that. Then some scientists come and do something with an eye tracker and da-da-da-da-da, and then arts professors, painters, and normal people suddenly say, wow, I'm seeing a color I have never seen before. So we should be very careful about intuitions about what conscious experiences are possible and impossible. They are ultimately grounded in our own biological history.
Stuff that may appear counterintuitive can be dangerous in itself. Obviously, you're talking about whether one can imagine not being a kind of self, because once you conceptually imagine it, then that's obviously related to your self phenomenological experience, and it gets into a paradoxical feedback loop. George Ray and the cognitive scientist, I can't remember his first name, but his surname's Frankish, on a paper about how when researchers of pain model consciousness on computers, they never assume the computer's in pain. Not because of the computational theory of mind, because they just intuitively never imagine that a computer can be in pain, which is interesting and also relates to what you're saying. Just one more thing here, which many people see as controversial, but a lot of the stuff that you've been saying kind of gets subsumed under the paradigm of evolutionary biology. So aspects of the notion of the self, the way we cognitively conceptualize the world around us, how we have phenomenological experience, how we might create the self, and this leads into intellectual and philosophical problems in terms of intuitiveness and everyday experience. I don't know how well versed you are in philosophy of science and realism and anti-realism, but a lot of this large paradigm, some people, they'd be on the fringe, but they could say, well, if you're grounding a lot of all this work in the scientific framework of evolutionary biology, that's still in itself a paradigm. And if you're an aggressive anti-realist, you could argue that evolutionary biology itself is a constructed paradigm in itself. So you're still making that assumption that you're basing all your study of conscious experience under that framework. So essentially, the question gets to the fact of to what extent you think this is a problem in realism, anti-realism, and you could be making the error that you're studying under a self-assumed paradigm.
Yeah, but what else can one do?
It's the best option on the table, I'll give you that, yeah.
So I think all we have, I'm not up to speed in theory of science, definitely not, but I'm this very, very old-fashioned. My intuitions are those of a scientific realist. Whatever structural assumptions our best scientific theories say about self-consciousness have to make, that is what we take as real as long as these assumptions are needed for the predictive success and the unification and simplification of those theories. My contribution in the last 30 years has in part been trying to show that self-consciousness can be scientifically explained in a very parsimonious framework, namely without assuming the existence of selves. I have tried to explain the phenomenology without these assumptions. But of course, if I use bottom-up constraints or data from evolutionary biology, I subscribe to a certain scientific methodology and I just take certain things for granted. So what we really and actually know is actually very little in many areas, but I think there's simply nothing better than the incremental progress the scientific methodology offers. I'm very open to this. I'm a long-term practitioner of meditation, for instance, as a private person. There may be completely different forms of knowledge that are non-discursive and ineffable and have nothing to do with true sentences and theories. But in the public space, I think this is the best option we have, and evolutionary theory is fantastically well confirmed. So it's rational and intellectually honest to go by this. But of course, tomorrow all of this might turn out to be false.
I mean, one thing that most people would say in terms of general realism is that one measure of a good scientific theory, apart from causal explanation and predictive power, is also the breadth of its explanatory power. And evolution as a general scientific realistic paradigm carries a lot of that. If you're ever interested in this area, you may already know him anyway, but Wolfgang Spohn, who won the Lakatos Award, he's got How to Rank Scientific Theories, very interesting. One more thing before I let you go is, what forthcoming research have you got in this area? Any forthcoming papers or books? Feel free to discuss them.
Well, you find a lot of material on my English website. I have this fantastic 5-year fellowship, so I'm exempted from all teaching and administration. So one thing you might look at is two massive open access resources I have created, Open MindNet and Predictive MindNet, where we've done an experiment, you know, in self-publishing and still having a 4-layer peer review process. I have written my last 4 papers on mind wandering. I wrote the first philosophical paper for many decades on mind wandering in 2013, because I think this is an area that has a big future. There's a lot of empirical research, and it shows something that many philosophers will find utterly provocating and will not believe. But it shows that for 2/3 of our conscious lifetime, we are not in control of our own conscious thoughts, actually, and that conscious thinking, as we've called it in the past, actually is a subpersonal process. It is something that is happening, and very rarely it is something that you do and control. So our whole conception of what is conscious thought and what is mental autonomy is undergoing a radical change currently. And I've tried to make some contributions as a philosopher there. That's the last thing I have done. And we'll see where I go next.
Thank you for that, Thomas. It's quite interesting to note that if 2/3 of your experience in life consciously isn't actually self-controlled planned consciousness, it almost makes the last hour redundant.
Okay.